13th state. This time around, we're going to be leaving our borders in one way, but not in another way, because our guest is Michael Hammerschlag. Now, Michael is a Rhode Islander originally. He's done a lot of traveling, been gone, I guess, for a little better than 10 years.
Oh, that's...
And let's put this in perspective, because we want people to know right off the bat, we're going to be talking about the area that used to be the Soviet Union, and that...
Far afield, as it were.
Sure is. Now, for 2 years out of a 2.5 year period that ended in this February, you were there, and you were writing for several English newspapers there.
A couple Russian, one Russian ones. Most of them were Western ones that printed in English. When I first got there, it was just one Moscow News. That was a Russian paper. And then by the time I left, there were about 12 English language papers and magazines in Moscow. I mean, it's 10 million people. It's a lot of people. And the foreign community is 100,000.
Okay, and you've also written for papers here. And I understand you work
for Projo, and I've done things with Seattle Times, mostly political commentary. And I was a radio correspondent for Radio South Africa. And I did some reports for King in Seattle, and a bunch of talk shows for them every time something exploded there.
Okay. You know, I think a lot of people who may have been following, for example, the Goodwill Games, I noticed a little bit over the weekend, there were some reports from St. Petersburg on how nice things are. That seems to be the American perspective. Since the communists are no longer in power, it's nice. That's not the perspective you get.
No, well, that's a wishful thinking. You know, Americans want to take Russians and put them in the Western box. Oh, well, they're just like us. They're a superpower. They're you know, very, very normal place. But it really isn't. I mean, it's not true. It's an Asian country. It's a very, and in really most ways, it's a third world country. I mean, these people landed spacecraft on Venus and did incredible things with military and industrial stuff. But they were putting 50% of their effort and money into it. You know, it's just a very, very alien place to begin with. I mean, everything is reversed. The R's and N's are reversed. The hot water is on the right. At night, they turn the headlights off on cars. And if you turn yours on, they'll flash the headlights at you. Turn the headlights off. They turn it on now. They've learned that. Mm-hmm. You know, the lowest paid professions were doctors and lawyers. I mean, everything.
Just the opposite of what we expect.
Everything, it worked the reverse of what you saw in the West. And, you know, it was just very, very strange to be there. And it's just it's a very, very abusive place. You know, the communism said everybody was equal, everybody was the same, and of course, people fought to prove them wrong. So every single person, everybody in power there, uses their power to torture everybody they deal with, from the lowest clerk to the highest official.
In other words, this is an individual's way of saying, see, I'm better than you, I've got this power over you.
Yeah, because it's a brutally aristocratic place. Even now, that's reasserting itself, you know? I mean, because the people were serfs. They were really slaves, the vast bulk of the people, until really this century almost, at the very end of last century.
I mean, in the days of the czars, when there was the nobility and there were
the nobility and there were
lords.
Property. You know, they're sold and they had some rights and they some of them were happy like that. I mean, it's a very, very, you know, strange kind of society that's almost feudal. And then overlaid on that was this communist egalitarianism that everybody's equal. And the way they made everybody equal is by taking everything away from everybody, you know. I mean, they destroyed. I mean, this is a country that basically. I mean, what happened there this century is almost inconceivable. You know, they killed 20 million of their own people in the purges, in camps, during forced famines. You know, and that was their own people. What the Nazis did for 5 years, the Soviets did for 35. And then on top of that, in the war, the Great War. I mean, that they call the Great War. The Germans killed like 28 million, and that's up from 20 million. They lied about a lot of the things, like in Stalingrad, where they won. They won this great victory in Stalingrad in March 42. That was the turning point of World War II. Mm-hmm. The Soviets lost 2 million dead. That's when they won.
In their victory, yeah.
Yeah, in their victory. And their losses were, you know, like 5. And I mean, just spectacular.
So what we've got there is a people that is a long-suffering. I shouldn't say people. We've peoples who are long-suffering.
Yeah, I mean, altogether in this century, it's maybe 60 to 70 million who are killed, and that affects everything. You know, because it's a country with delayed stress syndrome, just beset by that, the whole country. And you see it in the way they act, the psychological, I mean, the denial, the refusal to deal with things, the delusions, the alcoholism. I mean, you know, alcoholism is unbelievable there. At any time, maybe one out of five people are plastered, falling down drunk. And I'm talking about businessmen in suits and attaché case that fall backward downstairs and, you know, break their case open, rip their clothes to bits, you know. And Nobody thinks that's so terrible, you know. It's because it's a very cultural thing that, you know, it's just drinking to excess isn't considered bad, and that's, you know, that's what they want you to do when you first get there.
Well, you know, I can't help thinking, I mean, it wasn't that long ago when we considered, for example, Foster Brooks with his drunken comedy as really being funny.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it isn't so much funny, it's just this was one of their only entertainments, you know. I mean, they had, you know, in the big cities of Moscow, Leningrad, you have huge cultural alternatives, and some of the other ones you have these you know, incredible ballets and concerts, mm-hmm. and things that were nothing, that were pennies. I mean, it was an incredible place in the beginning. It was 100 times cheaper. When I got there, it was 100 times cheaper than America. A penny was a dollar, and the people made $8 a month.
It would have been, what, 1991?
1991, yeah, November. You know, it was just before the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it was, you know, I said, well, I think I'll stay.
Uh-huh.
I mean, because it was a world that was dying, and I said, I'm going to see this, you know, because this is disappearing.
This won't be repeated anywhere else on Earth.
Anywhere else, because,
yeah.
You know, they had the best metro in the world. It was 150 stations in Moscow, a train every 1 to 2 minutes, and the monthly pass was 15 cents, you know.
Wow.
It ran until, you know, from like 5 in the morning to like 1:30 or something. There were some things they did better than anybody else in the world, but most things were pretty terribly shoddy, and you know, just the fact that communism made this terrible compact with the people. You pretend to work, and we'll pretend to pay you. And that's really what happened. Anybody with any initiative in that country for 67 years was crushed, was destroyed, and they destroyed their best and brightest. And it's, you can see it in the way that people act, and even, you know, the people in power, how incredibly stupid they are sometimes.
Well, now, did that work in every strata of society? Because there are were some leaders in the communist era, but you talk about stupid leaders where, for example, before the Second World War, Stalin executed all his generals.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess that's an example, but then you get into the later days. Current leaders, are there leaders who are either in Russia now or the former Soviet states that are people who had something upstairs and they got elevated that way?
Yes and no. Mostly they're superb politicians. Communism taught people superb politics, and Yeltsin isn't excluded from it. And he's, I mean, he obviously needs it. Yeltsin really is a great man. He's a man of tremendous decency and tremendous courage. I mean, what he did, I mean, in 1993 in March when they were trying to impeach him and he declared special rule, I mean, it was like a Greek tragedy. The whole, I mean, he was about to probably be impeached there, and a couple of days, and the whole country rose against him, and all the conservatives, because the whole Supreme Soviet was then, you know, anti-Yeltsin, and they were fighting viciously back and forth. I mean, unbelievably, you know, like, it's not like in Russia you don't beat your opponent. It's like you beat your opponent, you stomp him to the ground, you kill him, you kill his family, you know.
There are no limits.
Yeah, just what Yeltsin did to Gorbachev. I mean, he threw Gorbachev out of his office on Christmas Day.
And,
you know?
And on international TV, he told him, this is what you read. I remember that.
And he took all these, you know, these perks away from Gorbachev every time they had a battle. But it was just tremendously exhausting. But in that, the end of March when that happened, you know, he declared, you know, special rule, emergency rule, mm-hmm. like he was going to shut down the Congress. And like a day or two later, his mother died, and it was just like a Greek tragedy. It was really tremendously moving, because this guy, I mean, to do what he did after the coup in '91, to just shut down the Communist Party, these people that had owned this country and ruled this country, and to do it with a moral authority that they didn't fight against him, and they just said, okay, because that's how corrupt that whole place is.
Well, he was the only elected leader in the country at the time.
The first one, ever.
That's
exactly. He was the first guy ever elected in Russia. And it was, you know, to do that just took tremendous, tremendous courage and whatever. And but, you know, having said all that, he is a basic Russian ruler and not immune from carelessness, sloppiness, imperiousness, dictatorial behavior. The government is really so flaky. It's incredible to be there, because they'll issue a decree every day, and you know, it'll contradict a decree of a week ago completely, and nobody will follow up on it. Nobody will enforce it. It just gives all these opportunities for bureaucrats to extort and corrupt money, you know, get money from it, and it's just very, very erratic thing. I mean, it's a very, very strange place.
Now that time period that you were talking about, where Yeltsin did end all the previous situation, was made it, it was what led to the ability of the other states from Russia to separate, to form the Commonwealth of Independent States. Now, we've got all these little countries in some cases, some very big ones, that were once united underneath something that came from above and said, you've got this social system, you've got this monetary system, you've got this educational system. Now, they're all going in different ways.
Yeah, I think basically that was the big mistake, because, you know, they met in the woods with the leader of Ukraine and Belarus, and they broke up the union, and this union was formed by 1,000 years of Russian blood and imperialism. This wasn't something that the communists did. And it was a terrible, terrible mistake, because it was done just so carelessly and so, you know, without thinking about any of the consequences. The whole economy was interdependent. The entire Soviet economy was interdependent. When they broke it up, they created all these jealous, resentful republics. They created new customs borders. They created customs duties. They created new money in these republics. And then it caused the entire collapse and paralysis of the economy across the Soviet Union. It's still happening. It's still happening.
Now, you talk about the new customs, for example. If you have an industry, say, for example, that gets its raw material from the Ukraine, but it's then processed in Belarus, and mm-hmm. then further processing is done in Russia.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they'd have a car thing, you know, and they'd make the transmissions in Belarus and the frame in Ukraine and the tires in Kazakhstan and the engine and
with
the assembly
steel from
in
the
Russia.
Caucasus.
Or, yeah, and it was, when they broke it up, that just paralyzed everything.
So now each part that moves across a border has to have a tax paid on it too.
Yeah, but mostly it's corruption, and it's mostly just the impossibility.
Oh, it's a payoff as opposed to a tax.
It's just, like I said, everybody uses their power to torture everybody. Mm-hmm. So these trucks will come to the border, and they'll have to sit there for 2 weeks because somebody hasn't got paid enough, or somebody's just being a jerk. And it has paralyzed stuff between the countries. And then there's all kinds of problems of payment. How do you pay between, you know, currency? Ukraine has their own currency now. It's toy money. It's not 80% a month inflation. It's worth nothing. How can they pay Russia when their money is disintegrating? You know, it was 50 coupons to a dollar when I went there first, and then now it's 50,000. You know, it's, what happened then, see, he tried to do another thing. He broke up the union, and then at the same time, he tried to change the communist system to a capitalist system by freeing prices. And he did that, you know, January 92. And what happened when he did that was all these big monopolies, who were basically owned by the government, and the government paid them, said, okay, and they raised their prices 10 times. And the other companies couldn't pay them. You know, everything was done, the whole economy, the Soviet economy, was basically all done with mirrors. You know, it didn't matter if nothing balanced, because the government would make it balance. Mm-hmm. But at that point, they said, we don't care about making it balance. And so these guys, these industries, ran up billions of dollars in effect of debts between them, and they were looking at the whole country shutting down and everybody, half the people being out of work. And so the government just started printing money.
So in other words, nobody had any experience in making things work.
No. Well, the thing is, they didn't do it by any kind of any economic model, you know, of the West. I mean, they had these real bright young people in Yeltsin's government, but they were so far removed from the ground level stuff, and they did incredibly stupid things. I mean, it really is terribly stupid what they did. And they didn't have control. See, it was a battle between the Supreme Soviet and the government, and the Supreme Soviet controlled the bank. The bank was Gerashenko. He's still there, and he's still there because during the October Revolt, I'm sure he basically said, gave Yeltsin a blank check for money, mm-hmm. for paying off the military, for paying off everybody, and that's the only reason he's here. He's there because this guy has done more to destroy the Soviet Union and Russia than anybody else on the planet. You know, he looks like Truman Capote, and I don't know what he's still in power for, but he just printed money, and what happened was incredible inflation. They printed trillions and trillions of rubles, and the ruble originally was about equivalent to about a dollar in purchasing power when I got there.
Okay.
From within 2 months of that freeing of prices went up 4 times. By the end of 92, prices were up 26 times. By the end of 93,
wow.
prices were up 500 times. Now prices are about 1,500 to 2,000 times higher than before the reforms, and wages went up also, but much less. So in effect, people are maybe between 2 and 5 times poorer. And that's why they're not happy.
Yeah, you can say that again. I just want to pause for a second and let people who are watching us on Tuesday, which is the evening that we're live, know that you can give us a call if you'd like. If you have questions or comments, feel free. Numbers are on the screen. If you're watching us live, if you're watching the rerun, the numbers aren't there. Now, Mike, let's talk, too, about some of the potentials for danger in the world. When the Soviet Union broke up, there were nuclear-tipped missiles that were aimed at the West, in most instances, in different parts of what was then the Soviet Empire. Now, how many different countries have their own nukes that it's up to them to decide what to do with?
Yeah, well, when it broke up, basically Ukraine and Kazakhstan became the third and the fourth biggest nuclear power in the world, each with about 1,000 bombs on missiles, and, you know, they pointed at us. I mean, when I was in Leningrad, and I'm wandering around, at some point I was just viscerally struck by the fact my country had about 30 or 40 nuclear weapons targeted on me.
Right, because you were there.
Like 30 minutes away. I mean, 30 minutes away. This is, you know, just over the pole. It's a very short distance. And the danger, really, of them being released in some way was real. Ukraine is utterly desperate. Ukraine has collapsed. The leader of Ukraine was Kravchuk, who was a hack, a communist hack, and he ran the country into the ground. Every bit of reform that Kuchma, who was then prime minister, tried to propose was stymied and by him in parliament. And he just lost. Kuchma just won, which is good, but he wants to bring Ukraine into Russia. And Ukraine is split now, east and west. 90% of the east voted for Kuchma, and 90% of the west, the nationalist west, voted for Kravchuk. And there's real potential for conflict there, terrorism, or actually a little civil war over the Crimea, over...
You can finish that thought. I just
Over to the Crimea, or over the Black Sea Fleet. Yeah. Or over the coal-producing region in the east that is mostly Russian. And if there's conflict there, there's a real chance of Russian intervention, because now even Yeltsin's government is speaking, you know, the nationalist decline that Zhirinovsky started about, because they have 25 million people in these other republics that are being systematically discriminated against and in some cases abused, some cases for good reason. I mean, you know, they were an imperial power that did terrible things in a lot of these countries. In Ukraine, they starved 6 million people to death, you know, deliberately. And, you know, they can't really forget that.
Okay. Let's go to our first caller, Roland in Smithfield. You're on Channel 36. Hi.
Yes. I've been, you know, very interested in this conversation. My only question is this, having, you know, studied the Russian language and something about Russia and all that. The thing that bothers me is, for all the cruelty and tyranny of Stalin, he took a second-rate, backward country and molded it into the second greatest power in the world at the cost of a lot of lives, actually. But what disturbs me now is that with the overthrow of Gorbachev, I think Gorbachev was willing to make changes, if not, you know, as rapidly as Yeltsin does. What I fear now is what you're saying is that it, what you have now in place of what was a dictatorship is chaos. Rivalry, so the situation isn't really better. How can you take a country that never knew capitalism, was feudalistic, like you say, and expect that it is going to transform itself to what we consider a free enterprise society or a capitalistic society? I just can't.
Well, you can't. Yeah, you can't. It needs 20 years. It needs 20 years to do that. You know, it needs a generation, but it doesn't have a generation. Not with the way things are going there. You know, the poverty and the criminalization of the whole society. You know, the mafia is the. That's another big factor. That when the communists stopped being major criminals, which in about the late 80s and early 90s, the mafia, the private enterprise mafia, moved right in. There was also a communist organized crime network. And it was very strange, because previously some of these people had actually defended liberty and been sent to camps for, I mean, they were executing people in Russia as recently as 12 years ago for capitalism, for making money. I mean, and that kind of whole mindset hasn't changed in a lot of ways.
No.
And it was just very, very...
Which must mean that people who were former KGB people, for example, having to protect successful business people, say, hey,
they can't, because you know they can't move from persecuting these people to prosecuting. They were arresting them and putting them in jail, and they made the businessmen then hang out with, you know, live in prisons with criminals, and then they came out as criminals. So when they did business, they did it as criminals and as mobsters, and they did it in that way to hide it from the government. And even now you have to hide things from the government because the government will take 50-60% taxes. They're crazy. They're crazy. They'll change the rules every day for businesses. You basically have to operate in the secret, in the black to Russia.
And work
to do
in
anything.
Cash, I guess. Don't have anything
on
the books.
Yeah, or trade. Yeah. And that even follows for Western business, because they do crazy things to Western businesses. They've driven a lot of Western businesses out.
Interesting point. Let's talk to Stephen in Canton. Stephen, you're on Channel 36. Hi.
Yes, thanks. There are many people in this country who would say this. Now that the conservatives in America no longer have communism and the Soviet Union to use in order to unite Americans, they are turning against single mothers, gays, and immigrants. Is there any parallel phenomenon within the former USSR now that they no longer have the United States and capitalism to use as a force?
Not really. I mean, they hate gays. They hate Russians are actually very prejudiced. They hate almost everybody in the southern people. You know, this myth of egalitarianism, of international brotherhood, was in many ways a myth. It was actually, you know, and it's strange to see these old communists that really believe that and say, oh, you can't do that. We're brothers. I mean, they deported all the southern people recently after the war. I mean, like, because and there wasn't one Russian, not one university professor, not one Russian that said this is wrong. I mean, they dragged doctors and people with you know, that had legal right to be there, and families and cars. They just threw them on trains. About 12 to 20,000 of them.
Was displaced
in Moscow. Just threw them out, deported, because they said, oh, you know, the criminals are, you know, and there were all these bands of Chechens and Azeris and Georgian criminal mafia groups. But the Russian mafia was always much bigger and much more powerful, and they just made things safe for the Russian mafia. And as far as gay stuff goes, there are actually, you know, those Russian Soviet laws that made it a crime. They just overturned that, and so it's not a crime. They can't. I mean, the people were thrown in prison for 5 years, just you know, for consenting sex or whatever. And so it's they're tired of America. I mean, when I first got there, they loved us. They loved Americans. Every single Russian would drag you home. You know, force you to eat, give you vodka, you know, introduce you to all your friends, and this is not, you know, not knowing any English, and you knowing little Russian.
Well, are they showing you off as their American?
Yeah, it was some of that, some of it was, they thought we had the secrets of money, success, power, whatever, and we could just tell them, and they could do it. I mean, they thought it was that easy. I mean, it's amazingly infantile culture in a lot of ways, you know, and I talked to my friend, a good friend of mine, you know, talking about the women, because the women are so protected there, and how they, you know, just act like little children until they're married, and then, you know, they go from property of their parents to property of their husband, and that happens at 20 or 21. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, you know, Michael, we were all children. I went to some restaurant college because my mother went there, you know, because I didn't want to have to think about it. You know, all the decisions were made for them. When I first got there, it was really heart-rending. They said, how do we live? How do we live? And I said, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. You know, do what you want.
That's
what do you want to do?
The 20 years, you need the generation to get there.
Yeah. But, you know, they're bright young kids, and you see that in the Goodwill Games. You know, see like a new generation of people coming up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Nelson in Coventry is our next caller. Welcome to Channel 36.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
All right. I just wanted to ask a question about what do you think the political landscape post-Yeltsin will look like? For a while back, we heard a lot about, I think his name is Sobchak, the mayor of St. Petersburg. But I haven't heard anything about him in the last 2 years, and he looks like a confirmed Democrat.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, it's really strange. Some of the confirmed Democrats are also incompetent people, and Sobchak was supposedly a real good guy, but most Leningradians didn't like him because he didn't do many good things. He really didn't do much. You know, these people, like I said, what they learn mostly is to be good politicians, and even that's good politicians to being a Democrat. I mean, a lot of these, you know, things didn't change a lot there. All across the whole the country, when they privatized companies, the boss, the communist boss, would many times just privatize it and become the owner, you know, mm-hmm. and to bribe the workers to privatize things. Like 70% is privatized, and this is really a great success story that they've done. It's a brilliant thing they've done because they gave the people a piece of property, a piece, a stake in their future. But to get them to do it, they had to bribe them by saying, by giving half the shares to the workers. Now what that means is they can't, they won't fire anybody, they won't cut down things, they won't renovate stuff, and so the foreigners aren't going to come in and sink money in there because they can't control it, and so nothing changes. The same inefficient, stupid system worked. And the inefficiency is staggering there. I mean, staggering. So like 50% of their potatoes rot because they dump them all in trucks and they don't have crates. I mean, they lose. I mean, they do more milk or more various foods than America does. But half of it goes to waste, or 30 to 50% is destroyed by waste, by just going bad because it's not refrigerated or not moved in time or whatever. It's amazing, how productive. And if they wanted to, Yeltsin wants to give back the land to the peasants and the combines, the combines, that's from what? So over Kuka's Nest, huh? The collectives are fighting that tooth and nail. These old babushkas, these people that work in these terrible factories. I mean, they do terroristic things against the private farmers that want to start something, want to build something, because they're supposed to be able to get some land now and actually harvest stuff. And it's impossible to get credit. You have to pay, 100-200% a year interest, on money, and banks just won't lend money because, they lose it. Nobody trusts anybody in Russia. Nobody, they have no history of...
Good example of that was something you and I were talking about before the show, something from everyday life that I think most Americans are aware of, the fact that when it comes to buying something in Russia, you go and you wait in a line. But we think, I think most of us think, that you go, you wait in the line to go and buy something, bring it to the register, check out, and leave.
No, you wait, you can wait. I mean, the line business was somewhat exaggerated. I mean, you really...
But the inefficiency times, it shows, yeah.
Yeah, many times you could get things in 5 minutes or 10 minutes. Sometimes you had to wait half an hour, and those were horrible, horrible things. But it was, everything was so badly done. You had to wait in line to see the product. You had to see all the products you wanted to see, write them down, write down the prices, at each department, write down the department number, then wait in line to go to the cash register to pay, and this is where huge lines were sometimes, these cash register lines, and people would cut. It was communist societies, like these women would just cut in front of you, and the line would grow 50, double as long. The people wouldn't say, what are you doing? Get out of here. They would let people cut. And, so you'd pay for the product. You pay for all the products, you get multiple receipts, multiple departments, then you have to go to the departments, wait in line at different each department to get what you wanted to get, and sometimes it was gone by the time you got there.
So then you had to wait in line for a refund.
And sometimes they close, and they said, no refund, you can't come back tomorrow, it's too bad you paid,
Too bad.
It's tough,
Want to follow up on one other thing we were talking about earlier in the show, the weapons that the different new states have.
Mm-hmm.
Are there moves in any of those countries, or is it likely, for example, that they're going to say, well, we know we don't have to worry about the West, which is where these are aimed. Why don't we sell to the highest bidder whatever is in these things, which
yeah.
could open up third world problem?
I mean, there's definite possibility. They're so poor. Ukraine is so desperate, and Kazakhstan and stuff. And these mafia groups are basically control the country now more than the government does. I mean, 80-90% of every single business, from the littlest kiosk to the biggest bank, pays off these hoods 20-30% profit. And if they don't, they're killed. They've killed 10 bank directors in 93, and five major ones sent a letter to Yeltsin pleading for help. And these guys, if they get their hands on it, I was thinking, well, maybe they're more responsible than that and they really won't do it, but they've sold just about everything else, and they actually found plutonium in Stuttgart, about 50 or 100 grams of weapons-grade stuff, and different things have appeared in different places. And these things really aren't that well protected anymore, because jurisdiction is very, very loose. Belarus returned them. Belarus doesn't really have them anymore. Ukraine and Kazakhstan still have a lot. Ukraine is returning them, as per the agreement with Clinton, and that's really, really good thing.
I wish we had more time. I told you it was going to happen. Michael Hammerschlag, who's spent a lot of time reporting and giving opinions from the former Soviet Union, good to have you here.
Okay,
welcome
it's
aboard.
Really, really good to talk
to
you, Paul.
And thanks for watching. See you next time on the 13th State.
July 1994. Paul Zangaria interview. It's Channel 36 PBS station in Providence, Rhode Island.